So it's the end of 2012, entering into 2013, and it's good to see people coming here and sitting quietly and entering into the new year in a way which I feel is quite skillful. In Thailand, this is a big evening for us. We'd all sit up and people would come and pay their respects, and it's quite a beautiful way to start the new year. So when we think of the new year, we think of time, and I guess a skillful thing to do is to contemplate, where have I been in the past year, not just geographically but in my heart, socially, where have I traveled? What are the good places I've seen, and what are the abysmal places I visited? Personally, I've had a geographically fabulous year. I was on four continents, and so there's that kind of reflection on just geography, what I've done, the postcards I've sent, kind of thing. But in the spiritual life, we're also contemplating the way the Buddha suggested we live our lives. And one of the kind of ideas that has come up for me recently is the idea of, in design, when we say that form follows function. So like you probably maybe saw some of the drawings there on the wall, we're going to build a monk's common area. We'll finally have more than one shower. It's going to be a great joy for me. And so we have a very good architect from Perth, and we've been talking with him what kind of rooms we need, what kind of situation we need. And then he lays it out and designs it, and then you have that, you have the form. So the form of the building evolves from the functional need of the occupants. And that need is dictated by building codes and weather, the need for light, windows, so on and so forth. So that's a very normal kind of thing in life, isn't it? When form fulfills a function, but fulfills it really simply, I find that very beautiful, very elegant. So I was thinking today, a coach bolt or a steel bolt and a nut, that to me is beautiful, because it's so simple, you know, the head of the bolt and the nut, they're the same size, so you could put a spanner on both of them. You can tighten the bolt really, really strongly, and it will do a fantastic job of fastening something. And it's such an elegant piece of structure. I mean, who thought of that? So sometimes we don't see how much beauty there is in simple things like that. We just take it for granted. I've been reading a book about, part of the book talks about the production of books in Greece and early Roman times and in the Middle Ages, and the simple invention of the codex. So before the codex, codex is what? Codex is numbered pages, an index. Simple idea. Before that, they had scrolls. So they had these scrolls, right? And then someone thought of pages, numbered pages, an index. I mean, that was some, I don't know, early Middle Ages. I'm not sure when it was invented, but that didn't get replaced until the search engine Google. And just something so, you know, a problem like that just has this really, really elegant solution. And we just take it for granted. Again, just pages and index. But if you think about it, it's brilliant. It's really, really brilliant. form follows function. Right? So there's a need to be able to access knowledge, and someone invents that. Or you look at trees, they say like this apple tree, how it can take this snow load and not break. And really, you go to the, you know, this is a beautiful apple tree out here, if you ever look. And its branches are very, very long. Some of the branches are very long. You go to the ends of the branches, it's really delicate, right? And you can see the whole branch move just by pushing it a little bit. It's very, very delicate at the end, and the center is just can't move it. Very solid. So it can bend with a snow load and carry apples. It spreads out to the sun. So trees are very, very beautiful aesthetically, but also they've grown for a kind of functional need, functional purpose. And so we find that principle all the time in nature. We find it in human invention. So I've been looking at meditation halls too. They're always sort of, I like architecture. My mother used to, I asked her, do you ever meditate? She says, yeah, I make buildings. She used to fantasize building a perfect house. And she would go through the house and build it. And she said that's the way she meditated. Did a kind of architectural visualization. So our architect is actually bringing some drawings of conceptual drawings for a possible meditation hall in the future. And that'll be exciting. So form follows function. And so Buddhism is really a very elegant form. It is very, very, when I think of it, it's a very beautifully designed teaching, but it has a function. It's not just an arbitrary artifact that you look at or believe in. So if you had a bolt and a nut, you put it on your shrine, it'd be pointless, wouldn't it? So if you just think about like this gathering we have tonight, if you think about the gatherings, if I think about the gatherings I had when I was 16, at this time of year, the form was different because the function was different. It was to make whoopee. And so the result the next morning was not good. But it had a function, right? To get excited, or once again to try to have fun, or to be convivial or whatever. So here we come together tonight and we just do a bit of chanting and sit quietly. And very elegant, actually. Very beautiful form. And the result is, I don't know, inwardly in your mind, but I'm sure it has, to some extent, a good result, even if you feel restless. But the result is both inwardly calming, composed, and then socially, as a group, as a corporate group, we have a sense of composure. So we enter into the new year with mindfulness, with composure. And that kind of composure gives us an opportunity for reflection. And the art of reflection is the, I think, the real, one of the great skills that the Buddha was trying to recommend and encourage in us, rather than belief. And so the danger in religion, I often talk about that. Maybe that's why I talk about form and function now, because the kind of just believing in things, you know, if you believe in a nut and a bolt that it'll work, but you never use it, what's the point? What's the point? I believe in Velcro. But Velcro works. It's an amazing invention. Really elegant. So the Buddha's teaching is kind of suggesting to us to make it alive, and to use it in a way. And its function is to liberate us from suffering. It's its function. To liberate us from suffering. So if you cast your memory back to this year, you contemplate, you know, what is it that I did skillfully that led to an end of suffering? What is it that I did unskillfully that led to more suffering? And those things which were kind of errors in judgment or misunderstandings. I think any time it's good to consider forgiveness, but especially New Year, can you kind of make a resolve that for anything I've done with body, speech, and mind to anyone in this past year, I ask for forgiveness. That's a beautiful reflection, even if you don't see the person or the situation. So for anything that I've done with body, speech, and mind, may I, you know, I ask for forgiveness. And then for anything that's been done to me with body, speech, or mind, I give forgiveness. So I'm trying to clear the slates away so that the mind isn't carrying a lot of bad memories and resentments. You know, the mind has some sense of uplift and freedom. And then perhaps also for anything that I've done to myself with body, speech, or mind, I ask forgiveness. A kind of sense of caring for yourself and not just seeing the spiritual life as some kind of self-whipping into shape. The kind of critical mind can always be very, very judgmental and be attached to its idealism and not realize how difficult the spiritual life is. So that kind of moving into a new year. Year is arbitrary. It kind of works around the winter solstice, right? It's a kind of arbitrary time. But it is good, I think, to take stock and to then consider what form do I want this year to be? What kind of form would I like it to be, both in my own heart and in my social environment? And how would that be conducive to the well-being of myself and others? So that one makes intentions. The kind of cliches of New Year around things like making New Year's resolutions on January 1st and then feeling guilty February 1st. You get a lot of humor about that and stand-up comedy and so on. So it can sound very, very cliched, New Year's resolutions. But intention is important, isn't it? You know, the way we cultivate a good life, both socially and inwardly, is through directing our body, speech, and mind, giving it direction, training the mind, training the body, training in skill. And so to give direction to this year is an act of, first of all, reflection, and then an act of intention. You intend to live in a particular way. And this is a very beautiful kind of undertaking. When the Buddha, we have the last words that we think the Buddha might have said was, that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. Work out your own liberation with diligence. Very simple. That which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. Work out your own liberation with diligence. Now, that's a very elegant kind of statement, but interestingly enough, it applies to all cultures. It applies to all genders. It applies to all ages, all situations. That which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. A year begins and a year ends. This is in the nature of things. This body was born, this body will die. This clock was made, this clock will be broken. So inherent in all things, if they were manufactured, this thing is brokenness. It's just the nature of it. There's nothing right or wrong about it. And to actually see that in all things that change, in all things that we experience in both our emotional life, in our bodies, in our families, in our relationships, in our cultures, in our size, in weather, and in just this planet, to see that is inherent doesn't sound very exciting, that's for sure. It might even sound depressing. But actually, that reflection is very, very peaceful once one begins to enact it, once one begins to live it. The function of that simple form, that which has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease, that which is born must die, the purpose of that form is to free us from suffering. Now, how does it free us from suffering? Well, what it offers us is a kind of mind which can see the movement of life and find a peace within the movement of life which is not dependent on the movement of life. Because as long as we're dependent on the movement, then we're always caught up in the birth and death of that movement. We feel inspired, well, inspiration will lead to the other. The lack of inspiration, boredom. We feel friendly, we feel unfriendly. We feel healthy, we feel sick. So this movement of our consciousness is dualistic. It comes and it goes, it comes and it goes. And so what the Buddha suggested, where we find peace is not in getting it right on some kind of emotional or social level, not getting it perfect, but finding that there is a peace of the mind when we know it has changed. That's very, very simple, if you think about it. Anyone can do that. It's not dogmatic. But not everyone does it. It's really hard to pick that up. So if I feel ill or disappointed, that's supposed to be that way. This is the way the heart and mind works. So to come to that realization, the Buddha then offers some kind of simple forms and structures where that kind of reflection is possible. And one of the simplest forms is really based upon the kind of golden rule, do unto others as you would have done unto you. To me, that's a very beautiful form. It's such an elegant phrase, isn't it? Do unto others as you would have done unto you. Or we call it goodwill, or metta. That's a simple teaching, isn't it? Do unto others as you would have done unto you. So if I get insulted by someone, or don't do unto others that you would not have done unto you. So someone insults me and I feel, wow, that was painful. I'm not going to do that to someone else. And that's like the nut and the bolt. This is very, very, very beautiful. It's like the tree in human consciousness to have this simple idea, elegant idea, but then to live that idea. And that idea then leads to an end of suffering. Because when my heart really functions from goodwill and not harming others, then there's a tremendous amount of gladness in the heart, isn't there? Whereas when the heart gets caught up in anger and resentment or revenge or all of those things, then the heart's very unhappy, very, very, very contracted. And that's not a kind of complicated analysis of life. Sometimes Buddhism can be so complicated. Books and books and books and books. And we can make it complicated. But actually to live a life of goodwill is straightforward but not easy. Sometimes the ill will that we experience as human beings is towards ourselves. Strong self-judgments or strong sense of idealism that we should be other than we are. Sometimes it's toward others, just kind of. Always finding some kind of fault with something, with governments, but just to kind of make conscious what is the feeling of goodwill. Is to begin to move to beauty. One of the things about the kind of emotional teaching that the Buddha offered, it points to that which is truly beautiful in the human heart. You know, you think about it, a human being who functions from a deep sense of goodwill. There's something very lovely about that. Very, very beautiful. As beautiful as the apple tree. And if you think about like the human mind when it's caught in its self-hatreds or jealousies or all that, it's not a very pretty affair. So the function of goodwill then is not idealism, but it's actually to train the mind, to train the heart towards that which is beautiful and towards that which is liberating, liberates us from suffering. And that is a training. And the Buddha said that as we enter into these practices, often our minds are not filled with goodwill. They can be filled with all kinds of unpleasant things. But we can train. We can make intentions. And so, like, rather than a New Year's resolution, it's a lifetime intention, isn't it? We can reaffirm it in a new year. We can say to actually try to practice just simple goodwill, super goodwill towards oneself and others. And as soon as one makes that intention, what happens is the mind notices ill will. As soon as I make that clear statement in my mind, this is good, this is beautiful, this is a lovely way to live my life in goodwill. And when I feel goodwill to myself or to others, and I feel that's really comfortable, it's really not caught up with suffering. It really is the path of freedom and peace. And I have that conviction, I have that understanding, I see that works, and I incline my mind towards that beauty, then that very inclination, that very intention, that very thought, that this is good, this is a good way to go, will illuminate for me that other direction. And that other direction, I'll say, no, I'd rather not pick that up. It'll come, it'll be there, ill will be there. But that's not, you know, that I don't want to go that way. I don't want to live my life in a constant way of self-hatred or self-judgment or whatever. And that's the training of the mind, to uphold the beautiful and to not believe in that which is divisive and alienating. Because those are very, very alienating energies, aren't they? When I think of the natural, like this winter, I haven't had to shovel any snow, so it's been very happy for me. It's very beautiful, isn't it? You've got a good coat and snowshoes and shit. It's just the shapes of the shapes of the snowscapes, huh? The shadows and where the wind sculpts the snow, and the fields have no footprints on them. To me, that is really very elegant and very beautiful. And what that brings to mind, when I look at that, it brings gladness. It's a kind of happiness to the mind. Kind of wonder these beautiful forms. And gladness is a way that we can incline our minds too. That as human beings, we have this capacity for beauty. We can incline to that. And sometimes nature offers that to us. In that way, and what nature is showing us, it's not just about the snow; it's about our own hearts and minds, isn't it? That we have a capacity for gladness. Now, gladness, or uplift, or mudita, as we say, is not the same as excitement. It's not exciting the mind. It's finding something really wonderful in human consciousness, which isn't self-referencing. Self-referencing, when I was thinking of myself or thinking of you in terms of my judgments of you, I'm still thinking about myself, really. That's a very kind of constricted and unhappy state of affairs. If I'm always just, like, if I think the spiritual life is just analyzing myself and thinking about myself, but you go outside and see a blue sky and just stop and look and let the mind be quiet. And allow the shape of the snow to be there. And the mind settles into something which is not self-referencing. It's no longer about me trying to figure something out or get somewhere. It's just this way. It's just this way. It's just this beautiful snowscapes. So the Buddha recommended that we move the heart to gladness. How do you do that? Well, it's not done through sensual desire. Gladness isn't having banana yogurt. Well, it is a bit. If you like banana yogurt, it's different, isn't it? You know, the kind of openness of the heart. Gladness is more like an empathy with beauty. An empathy with beauty. So in each of us, there are beautiful characteristics. Sometimes people come to me and they... I was talking to a friend the other day and struggling with a very real social issues and a lot of pressure and so on. And then I was admiring her tenacity. Oh gosh, you're really tenacious. You're really sticking with it. And that was a kind of gladness in my heart, which I was able to share with her, which was nice to do. So we see that in each other, don't we? We see like a lot of beauty and good characteristics. Someone's very moral, or someone's very generous, or just sticks with it or is very honest and so on. These are lovely characteristics that we all have. And to glance at humanity in that way is a balance to the critical mind, because all of us have faults, you know. I don't see any huge halos glowing here. Some Buddha halos, right? And especially with ourselves, you know, we all. I don't know about you, but I can find fault with myself, like right, left, and center, 24/7. I don't know about you. I'm very good at it. So I don't need to do that. I don't need to find my faults. You know, it's much more skillful to look at that which is beautiful. Now that can sound very self-referencing. You know, aren't I wonderful? Look at my shape of my nose or something like that. But it's not that. You know, it's just a very, very real recognition of the good qualities of our life. We've got a good karma that we do. So this you find a lot in Asian Buddhism. You'll find where the teachers will say, you know, this is very meritorious to do this. This is very wholesome to do this, to come together and to sit in meditation and to contemplate the Dhamma. These are very good things, very wholesome things. And to that sense of encouragement. And that's very important, because a spiritual life, it's a tough number. I don't know about you, but I don't find it easy. You know, I've been giving it a go a few years, but it certainly is a lot of kind of cul-de-sacs and screwballs that get thrown at you, and so we need to have some way of uplifting the mind, and gladness is a way we can do that. Sometimes we do it through nature, sometimes we do it through the arts, oftentimes we do it through children. To see a child's joy in creating something very simple, the innocence of the child, or to see it like forming its first words or things like that. These are ways that gladness comes up naturally. And then you can do it quite deliberately. You can, and so we have practices, don't we, for that. And the kind of example I always cite is when I was taking care of Mom, I would be coming back from here on a Sunday. I'd come on the Saturday morning from Ottawa, where I was taking care of Mom, and then I'd return on Sunday around 4 o'clock. And then I'd go on the way back, we'd go into Carlton Place, into the Independence store, and buy some cut flowers. Whoever was driving, and then I'd go to Mom's flat, and she was very happy to see me. And then the night say, "Bam, flowers," and her smile was even bigger. And that was so joyous. It was such a joy. Because she had, you know, a lot of pain and a lot of suffering of the elderly. Yeah. And then to see her happy and to see her senses actually having some gladness, because the sense realm for elderly people is not a happy realm. All the kind of pain they have and disabilities, it's not a happy realm. But to see her have that kind of joy brought a lot of joy to me, kind of gladness. And then I'd use that. I'd use that in my meditation. In the evening, I would make that conscious, bring that image up into my mind. It's, oh, this is gladness. Gladness feels this way. And what a beautiful way to enter into meditation. So it's good to do glad things. You know, robbing banks isn't going to give you good memories. So to do like acts of generosity, not to be shy about that. To kind of give and realize the joy of giving and to also receive. This is also beautiful. Sometimes we don't know how to receive. You know, people, "Well, I don't need that, I don't need that." It's not about you. It's about receiving. And we can squelch someone's joy at wanting to give, right? Can it? Because we're just thinking about ourselves. So receiving is important. How do you receive someone's generosity, right? Someone compliments you, say, "Oh, no, 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 it's not true." It's not about, don't you get it? So we get into kind of a self-disparaging state, which then spoils the gladness for the other person. But to actually receive a compliment and say, "Oh, thank you," very graceful, very beautiful. And so beauty, I think, is a very important part of the spiritual life. Not, you know, not beauty as some kind of aesthetic. That can be nice, but beauty is something of the heart. And the human heart has a great, great capacity for beauty. We take compassion. I think most of us are very good at compassion. That is a wonderful quality, isn't it? If humanity, where we can, you know, we can see someone's distress and we can put our own agenda down and we can say, how can I help in your distress? How can I make your life more comfortable and more at ease? And this quite often puts a lot of demands on our energy. So caring for our parents, caring for elderly, caring for sick people, it's very demanding, very, very demanding. You have to give a lot. You have to really give a lot, go past. But if there is true goodwill and true compassion, we can do a lot as human beings. I certainly found that with my mother. I could really push myself to quite exhausting kind of situations, but it was all right. It was just exhaustion. It was just tiredness, really. And the result of that, stretching ourselves out of compassion, is very good. The result can be bad. We can get burnt out. Certainly, that's a danger. But the result of actually putting our own agendas aside and practicing the beauty of compassion has a very good result in the heart, because that those energies of compassion and gladness and goodwill, they begin to dominate. And they're not egotistical energies. They're not self-referencing energies. And so the heart begins to abide as beauty. And that, we would say, the function of that beauty, that beautiful form, is liberation of the heart. Because it leads to a kind of consciousness which no longer really needs that much. It's not a consciousness which is always, if you think about like all the forms of consciousness which really contract us and create alienation, fearful states of mind, greedy states of mind, a lot of analysis, jealousy, those kinds of things are very kind of contracting. And then I always need more from the world. A very judging state of mind. I'm always kind of looking out for myself or in alienation from the judgments and such like. But these states of mind begin to the beauty of a mind which experiences contentment. So this year I've been writing my New Year's cards to friends, and I'm always curious to see what my line is going to be, because you've got to have your line, right, for New Year's. What's going to be my original line? Oh, everyone's doing that one. So I found the words I was using was good health, prosperity, and profound and deep contentment. Right? Contentment is something that is, you see, it's quite rare in human beings. It's quite rare. Usually we're always restlessly trying to do something or get something or judging something. Even just meditators, we're all trying to get enlightened, you know. Relax. And so like contentment, where does contentment come from? It doesn't come from getting what you want. That, to some extent it does, getting enough food and shelter and clothing. It doesn't come from greed, does it? It doesn't come from just accumulating objects. Obviously, we know that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. But where it does come from is functioning from those beautiful heart qualities of goodwill, of compassion, of gladness, because they're very, very fulfilling. They're very fulfilling. They don't, you know, generosity. When you feel generous, you've always got something to share, right? You always have more, so it's not a question of need. And so that foundation of emotional gladness and compassion and goodwill then is a foundation for actually going more deeply into the silence of the mind. So the beautiful form serves a function. And that function is enlightenment. That function is to touch the deep possibility of freedom that the Buddha recommended. When one talks in these ways, it can sound very sentimental or unrealistic. You know, it's a real world out there, dog eat dog and all that, or dog eat cat and whatever's going on out there. I don't know, but it is actually It's very pragmatic. That's the thing about it. It's not just idealism. Where idealism fails is we think we should be loving, we should be glad, we should be caring, rather than inclining towards those states of mind. And what's the difference? What's the difference between training the mind to know gladness, training the mind in compassion, training the mind good? And what's the difference between that and idealism? Well, idealism is a should be. You know, I should love everyone all the time, or whatever it is. But the skillfulness of the contemplative is to know what is skillful and unskillful, to know the mind, to train the mind. And when the mind is producing unskillful thoughts, unskillful perceptions, to not believe in them, to just not believe in them, to not go there. So if I feel really critical of someone and I just hold on to that, I say, criticism feels that way, and I'm not going to entertain it. You're kind of an averse critical mind is fine. You have to, you know, you're at work and someone's totally incompetent, then you have to fire them. It's just the way of work. But that kind of mind, which is always averse and always cynical and always judgmental, I suffered a lot when I came into monastic life. I had a really cynical streak, and still is a kind of tendency where I can go. And that was a very strong habit. Very strong habit, but it was a very unhappy habit. It was not gladness, that's for sure. It was kind of marginally clever, but not very pretty. And so I could see in my own mind, my mind would just go there, just kind of cynical comment on life. And then I realized, well, do I really want to be like that the rest of my life? I was only 26. Do I really want it? Is that the way I want to look at the world? I said, not really. And every now and then, my teachers would give me some reflections. And do you really want to be like that? Which was very healthy. And then I saw other models. You know, I'd see Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, and Ajahn Lim, these teachers here. And I'd see, yeah, their minds, you know, have a different perspective. And then I could see, okay, I need to, you know, I could understand that's not skillful, that's not beautiful, that's not happy. And then how do we do it? So the idealism was I shouldn't be cynical. I won't be cynical. No way, I was cynical. I won't be cynical. And I start, you know, when I wasn't watching, cynical, cynical, cynical. And okay, so how do I train the mind? So in training the mind, first of all, we have to be willing to understand. Understand what is the source of happiness and clarity and joy, and what is the source of unhappiness. So there has to be a willingness to actually just look at the way it is. What is it? What was my mind producing now without idealism? Idealism usually just rejects things. Attachment to idealism. Ideals are fine, but attachment to idealism. No, it's this way now. The mind is cynical, or the mind is frightened, or whatever. So how can I move away from that? How can I move to other perceptions? And that's the skill of contemplation. And then as I see that these habits of consciousness, habits of emotion that I'm picking up, I begin to, first and foremost, not believe in them. So my own struggles with, say, like cynicism, I just had to not believe it. I don't believe you. And move away from the thoughts. And then the other practices of gratitude, generosity, those do have to do a lot of. Fortunately, I had a kind of atmosphere I could do that. So just taking care of my teacher, taking care of Ajahn Sumedho, or taking care of his kuti, or cleaning his hut, or washing his clothes. I began to have an avenue of expressing gratitude. And that felt really, really good, really good. So then, as we actually work on this, the power of the mind to change becomes apparent. Because the more we make intentions and actions towards that which is wholesome begins to dominate. And we begin to see the beauty of that. The beauty of that. And we have this capacity to train the minds. We have a capacity to see cause and effect. We can do that. But it takes tremendous patience and determination. But it's a what perhaps what I'm trying to indicate in this talk, it's a movement of beauty rather than a movement of coercion. It's a movement of the heart rather than just kind of like analytically beating ourselves up. It's a movement of it's a kind of gentle training of the heart rather than a willful suppression of things or whatever. It takes a lot of honesty. It takes a kind of inner vigilance to do that. So when we think of the Buddha, or the closest thing I had to in my life to a Buddha was Ajahn Chah, and his manifestation of this teaching was really very beautiful. It's really, he was a beautiful being, and one of the things really beautiful about him is that he was never hurried, never in a rush, and he was I think he was 5'2", right. And he walked the most regal way, just this beautiful, mindful walk. Always in charge, always mindful. And then we would be at the meal, and we were maybe 50 monks and novices, and we'd all be waiting for him, and he'd come in, and I would be in a hurry to get into the food, because we only had it once a day, and there was nothing else, I tell you, there was... If I saw coffee once a year, it'd be fantastic. So this meal was important. And it wasn't fancy, but it was important. And Ajahn Chah would just come in, like just float in. And everyone's kind of looking, come on, let's go. And he's just so unhurried. And the pressure, like 100 eyes on him. And he'd bow, he'd come, and then he'd... Sometimes he had several sets of false teeth. He had one set for eating, one set for giving Dharma talks, and one set for betel nut. So sometimes he'd do change them or wash his hands or something. And I did think he was torturing us sometimes. He'd fiddle, and then he'd finally just kind of mindfully start eating. And then the etiquette was like we had to wait for the guy in front of us. So when I was a novice, I was the last of 50. It was torture. It was torture. But just to see someone who had really kind of staked his life on the Dhamma and dedicated his life to Dhamma and worked really, really hard. And when you read about Ajahn Chah's own struggles with lust, a lot of lustful energy, very, very, very challenging for him to deal with that, and various other things. He was no kind of arahant when he was born. He had stuff to work on. And in his biography, actually, some of the biographers wanted to edit out some of the difficulties he had. Said, no way, that was the real practice. And that kind of dedication to the practice, the result, very, very. Very beautiful human being, really, and people love to be with him. Just love to kind of sit with him. And so sometimes in Buddhism, we stress suffering and the end of suffering, but the results are truly beautiful, very beautiful. And then the heart does feel this I think more and more this deep contentment with the way things are, because going back to that first statement, because when we abide as that wisdom, that which has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease, then we don't demand of the world that it be a certain quality. We don't demand of others that they be a certain quality. That which has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease. So sometimes we feel pleasure, sometimes we like each other, sometimes we don't. But that's, that change just in the nature of things. So refuge then, that very, very simple teaching, that very elegant teaching is a kind of the kind of, I guess it's the intellectual form we take on, that which has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease. And as you apply, as one applies that to every moment, the mind begins to just know this way of being with things in a way of non-desire, in a way of contentment.